You are listening to the Tricorder Transmissions, episode 38. And
now,
here are
Craig
and
Jeff.
Welcome to yet another installment of the Tricorder Transmissions. We are your hosts, Jeff Hewlett.
And Craig Cohen.
This week, we are going to be covering the episode Metamorphosis.
Yeah, and it's got a quite an interesting guest star in terms of character.
Yes, it does. So this episode is probably pretty important in the pantheon of Trek as it introduces some staple concepts and things. So it's going to be fun to talk through this.
Yeah.
I haven't actually seen this episode that many times in my Trek watching. I've seen certain episodes I've seen a lot of times, and some I've only seen a small handful. And this is probably one of the ones that's in the small handful
category. Yeah, I think this is my second time watching it.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah. Cool.
So a couple things of interest happened this week. I think the most significant thing that happened this week is Craig and I met Walter Koenig at the New Jersey Chiller convention last weekend.
Yeah, what a cool experience. Really nice guy, and you surprised me and Walter both when you gave him a Tricorder Transmissions pin.
Yeah, I was kind of on the fence about whether I was going to do it or not. I had it in my pocket, and I was thinking, you know, if the opportunity presents itself when I'm standing there and talking to him and having a pic and doing that picture with him, maybe if the mood strikes me and it seems like the right thing to do, I'll hand him the button. And he seemed really down to earth and in a good mood. And there weren't a lot of people in line behind us. So I thought, you know, I'll give it a shot. I'll just hand him the button. So I wound up giving him a little bit of a spiel about, you know, you and me being a host of an original series podcast. And, you know, this button has our logo on it. And we just wanted you to have this. So, you know, thanks for, you know, being a part of the series, and we're really glad we finally got to meet you. So I start to walk away. He seemed to appreciate, like, oh, thank you. You know, he didn't say a heck of a lot, but he's like, oh, thank you. That's great. As I started to walk away, another guy that we were with kind of tapped me on the shoulder and said, look, turn around. I turned around, and he's putting the button on his jacket. He has a Babylon 5 jacket on, but he's putting the Tricorder Transmissions button on his jacket right after I had given it to him. And I was kind of in awe. I was like, whoa. And I took a picture of him putting the button on, and he noticed that I was taking pictures, so he kind of did a little pose, right?
Yeah.
His kind of proud pose with the button on. So we have a photo, two photos actually, of Walter Koenig wearing our Tricorder Transmissions show button. That was a hell of a highlight.
Yeah, and odds are if you saw him on Friday night, our button, our pin was probably on his jacket, and who knows, it might have stayed on the whole weekend. Once it's on, there's really not a reason to take it off.
Yeah, we don't know. I mean, it could still be on that jacket to this very day.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when we see him in, or if we see him in Las Vegas, we'll ask him about it. See if he still got it. So who knows? But that was a very, very cool thing. So we'll put our photos up on the Tricorder Transmissions website and the Facebook page. So each of us got a picture of ourselves with Walter, and then we have the pictures of him with the button on. Anybody else cool that we met at the con that would be significant?
I don't think there was anybody Trek related.
I don't think so.
Anybody else that we ran into.
Right.
Chiller's always a good time though. I don't know how coastal conventions like that are, or you know how many of those sort of happen around the country. But up here in the tri-state area, we tend to get the two core ones, which are Chiller and then Monster Mania. Between those, you get four events a year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty neat. And
yeah,
they really stack them up. This chiller was pretty loaded.
Yeah, we've been going for a number of years together.
Yeah,
and I know you were going for a long time before we started going together, but I have to say, in the past couple of years specifically, the two cons have gotten much, much better, in my opinion, as far as the caliber of the guests that they've been getting and the venues that they're now inhabiting are much better than they used to be, you know, 3 to 4 years ago, 5 years ago.
Yeah, now we just need people to stop watching The Walking Dead.
Huh. Yeah, I know The Walking Dead has, as much as I love The Walking Dead, The Walking Dead has really crippled these conventions, because you get one or two names from The Walking Dead on there and the place is just overrun with people. It's amazing. I mean, the last at Monster Mania, it was Carl and Herschel, right? And the lines were wrapped around the building, hours long. And this time, all you had to say were the words Norman Reedus, and it was complete bedlam at Chiller. I mean, I could not believe that line had to be at least 3 hours, if not longer.
There were lines everywhere, because we walked up to the building. There was a huge line wrapped around the front of the building. Then there was that point where we were on the second floor, and that was the same line.
I thought the upstairs was the professional photo op line for him, and the downstairs was the regular line.
Yeah.
But irregardless, the professional photo op line was so long, you couldn't even see the end of it down the hallway. It was so long.
It made my head hurt, and I wasn't even ever planning on waiting on it.
Me either. But yeah, it was unbelievable. It completely amazes me, because I mean, we've been going to these cons for a long time, and we've seen lines before, but never to the lengths of these lines. I mean, I waited, 40 minutes for Mickey Dolenz, and I thought that was terrible.
Yeah, I've waited. I mean, I waited a few years back. I waited close to 4 hours for Robert Englund.
Wow.
And then recently, I waited a couple hours to meet Paul Stanley from Kiss at a book signing, but I'm not sure that really counts.
Yeah, I don't think the book signing counts, because that's a specific one person, you know, at one event. This, you know, for an event that has, you know, 30, 40, 50 different celebs at it, for one person to have a line that's 4 hours long, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So anyway, moving along, a couple small Trek-related, original series-related news bits, both involving original series cast members receiving awards. So George Takei is getting an award from GLAAD, which is the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. He'll be getting an award called the Vito Russo Award at a ceremony in New York. So good on you, George. Congratulations ahead of time. That's really cool. And, well, he's an outspoken voice for the gay and lesbian community. So makes sense that he would be honored by that association.
Oh, yeah.
All right. And Shatner received an award from NASA. So he received an award that's called the Distinguished Public Service Medal. It is highest award bestowed by the agency to non-governmental personnel.
Yeah.
So pretty cool.
Yeah, good for him.
Yeah.
It's exciting.
Yeah, he got it for outstanding generosity and dedication to inspiring new generations of explorers around the world and unwavering support for NASA and its missions of discovery.
It actually seems kind of late for him to get that. You'd think that would have been an award he got 30 years ago.
Yeah, really. But he apparently, I didn't realize how much time he's dedicated to NASA over the years. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool that the captain of the fictional Starship Enterprise received a real award from NASA.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And finally, this past week, we released our 8th supplemental log episode discussing the Kickstarter program for a program called Star Trek Equinox, The Night of Time, which is going to be an original series time period movie starring Gary Lockwood reprising his role as Gary Mitchell and John Savage, amongst others. And we were able to sit down with four members of the project, two actors and two behind-the-scenes people, the writer and the CGI guy, and we were able to talk to them for a while about this project.
Yeah, it's pretty neat, and I think by the time this airs, they'll be in their last couple days, but it looks like a really exciting project, and it's got some really exciting people involved, including Stan the Man Lee of Marvel Comics fame. Who has agreed to be in it. But if you haven't listened to that episode yet, it's worth a listen because everybody we talk to has a pretty interesting story to share with us. And you'll learn about this Kickstarter and hopefully see the value in supporting it.
Yeah, I agree.
I know I'm looking forward to seeing the final results because it's definitely an intriguing concept.
Yeah, I am too, and it was tough to not try to pry in for some spoilers through these interviews because the concept itself, knowing that Gary Mitchell has somehow arisen from his rocky grave and is now back aboard a Starfleet vessel is intriguing in its own way, how they got there. So I'm really anxious to see how they pulled that off. So hopefully pretty soon we'll be getting a short pilot trailer that we can maybe get a little more information out of. On to Metamorphosis. Metamorphosis originally aired on November 10th of 1967, and its remaster aired on November 3rd of 2007.
And I have a quick snippet from the TV Guide entry from the replay in July of 68. The officers of the Enterprise take part in a strange drama born of an alien's love for a human being.
All right. So we will get started with our scene-specific commentary in 3, 2, 1.
So we've got...
And it opens on a shuttlecraft.
Yeah.
That is quite different than what we've seen before.
I guess the Galileo sister ship.
Yeah. Yeah. So looks the same. Yeah. Looks the same. But I got to look up and see how many shows started with a flyby that wasn't the Enterprise.
Probably not many. It's got to be a very, very low number. I think this is maybe the second or third time in all the episodes we've covered so far.
Hmm. And I think the Enterprise itself, I don't think even shows up in this episode until about halfway through.
Yeah, you know what? That's an excellent point. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're learning.
I was going to say the one thing that's interesting about the shuttlecraft is how different it is from a design perspective than the Enterprise in that they don't have a forward view screen.
Right. They don't have a forward view screen, and it looks like any windows in the front are actually covered up or closed.
Yeah, I mean, that is a very, very claustrophobic-looking shuttle.
Yeah, I would be a little bit nervous not being able to see outside.
It almost feels like you're probably, it's like a submarine.
Hmm. Yeah, it is like a submersible, definitely. Spock is looking into some strange orb, and now they've got two of them. I guess that's how they see...
Yeah.
What's out front, and they rotate, no less.
Yeah. So, maybe gives you some kind of control of what you're seeing.
Yeah. So important. Oh, there go the drop. All right. So important plot point is there's a female on board, and she has something I think called Sakura's disease.
Yeah.
So that's something that's going to come up again in a little bit. I just wanted to make sure we put that in there.
Yeah, and she is being escorted to another planet. She's ranked somewhere in Starfleet.
Mm, yeah, she's an ambassador of some sort, and she was just on another planet helping to prevent some sort of a war from occurring. She briefly touched on it.
Yeah.
And headscarves are apparently still around in the future.
Yeah, that was the funny thing about this, is this episode... it really felt to me like her costume, her outfit looked like something she could have walked out of, onto the set from the street wearing.
Oh yeah. That definitely has a late 60s vibe to it for sure. The colors and the style definitely looks of the time period that the show was made, not of the time period that the show was supposed to depict.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting there, too? This is close to the first time that we're seeing a, or if not the first time we're seeing a human from their, you know, the original series time period, you know, who's part, you know, feasibly from Earth, who's not dressed in, you know, official gear.
That's true. You know, she is sort of in a dress down.
Yeah.
Clothes.
Whereas I think all the other humanoids we've seen, you know, we saw, you know, we've seen other human characters who have really been from other planets. But this really seems like the first one of this might give us an indication of what people were dressing up like on Earth in the 23rd century.
Hmm. And this episode also has another interesting first. It's not the last time it'll happen in the series, but this is the first episode in the first two seasons so far in which Kirk is not on the Enterprise at any time during the plot.
Ah.
So we see him on the shuttlecraft and see him on the planet. And, you know, the Enterprise itself doesn't even come into play until later on, I guess, as the search begins for the shuttlecraft. All right. So our shuttlecraft has been pulled
down. It's the Galileo.
Yeah, has been pulled down onto a planet by an unknown force.
I thought it was the Gemini for some reason. So this was the same shuttle that was in the Galileo 7.
It appears so.
Wow. Why did I think it was the Gemini?
It was tough to see on the front.
Yeah, that doesn't look like the same shuttle, though, either, does it? Weren't there more people? Well, the Galileo 7 had, what, seven people?
Well, it's reconfigurable inside, it seems. There's some computerized stuff in the back.
Are they really pulling chairs out?
Yeah, why not? Why not?
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So now we're on some sort of an alien planet, and they're going to go out and reconnoiter. Check up. Phasers have come out. So we're ready for action. I love how those doors opened.
Yeah.
That was really neat.
Clear as day. I don't know. I must have imagined it was a different ship because
now, strange planet surface, purple sky with some like lime green areas out there, and I wonder how the ship got in there. It's kind of inside of a little rocky cove there where it's sort of, it doesn't look like it could go straight up and down.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of room for it to have maneuvered its way in there. It seems like a strange place for it to have landed. So,
yeah.
I think we'll find out how it got there shortly. But
yeah. So this episode, it's worth pointing out that this is one of the episodes that was written by producer Gene L. Kuhn. He also wrote Arena and Space Seed and The Devil in the Dark. And upcoming, we're going to be watching his episode, A Piece of the Action. But the thing I think that's interesting here is he was the writer of Space Seed, which I mentioned, and Space Seed went on to sort of spawn Star Trek II. Mm-hmm. And then we have another episode that he wrote that was cherry picked for one of the Next Generation movies, which it's kind of interesting that that his ideas and his concepts worked their way into feature length Star Trek films.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a very great point. And now we're actually going to meet the reason why this the person behind this episode who is being picked for the Next Generation movie First Contact, the gentleman Zefram Cochran.
Yeah, so we might as well talk about the elephant in the room.
Sure, sure.
In the movie, played by James Cromwell. But here it's a younger, much different version of Zefram.
Yes, yes. This version of Zefram Cochran does appear to be much, much younger than the version that we see in the Next Generation on Earth, supposedly before he blasted off in his first warp ship, right?
Yeah, Kirk says he doesn't look more than 35 at one point when they learn who he is.
Hmm.
Because in this timeline, Zefram should be long dead.
Yes. Oh, so she's a commissioner, by the way, not an ambassador.
Okay. Commissioner Nancy It's Nancy something.
Not Crater.
No. Nancy Hedford.
Hedford.
That's actress Eleanor Donahue.
Hmm.
Age 77. Still alive.
Oh, still kicking.
And she played Betty on Father's Knows Best.
Oh.
And she was also a store clerk in Pretty Woman.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. She's still out there doing some work.
Yeah.
Very cool. You know, for someone who's been stranded on that planet for a long, long time, his clothes look really good.
Yeah. And it's funny. You mentioned that he's been stranded on that planet a long time. That's sort of what I almost use as an excuse to look past his performance.
Yeah.
I don't know how you feel about his performance, but to me it feels very, there's something off about it.
Mm. Yeah. I agree. It's hard to put into words.
Yeah. It's either a great acting choice or, or just an awkward performance. I haven't seen a lot of Glenn Corbett's work. He died in 1993 at the age of 59 and was popular on the show Dallas in the 80s playing Paul Morgan. And then earlier in the 60s, he starred on the third and fourth season of Route 66. But this is the only work I've really seen him in. And I don't know. I kind of feel like maybe he was like, hey, I've been alone on this planet for several years now. Maybe my social skills have diminished a little and I have a tendency to talk with a very sort of matter-of-fact delivery.
Yeah, well, we'll soon learn that he's been living with the companion who was, not human. So perhaps, over the years of dealing with just the companion, his demeanor around actual humans is a little bit different. He's kind of lost that. A little bit of that skill. Maybe he's a little bit. He seems pretty happy to see them, though.
Well, yeah, yeah. I'd imagine that's the reaction most of us would have.
Hmm.
But at the same time, there's something kind of suspicious with his the way he's interacting with them, because he doesn't really seem too interested in them. You know what I mean?
Hmm.
And it might be more because he knows at this point, maybe even indirectly, that they're not getting off the planet.
Yeah, he's already told them that their ship will not be able to be repaired or take off because there's a dampening field. So even if they could get the ship working, whatever that field is going to be keeping them on the planet. So they're pretty much stuck.
Yeah, and then here's our first indication that something's off. Kirk immediately notices that his equipment, he refers to them as antiques.
Hmm. Yeah, some strange looking, mechanical looking parts strewn about that table there. And they're pretty unidentifiable to the normal eye, our eyes. I don't know what any of them are exactly supposed to be necessarily. They just seem to be random things stuck together. But I guess they're some sort of, ship parts of indeterminate origins.
Yeah.
Or indeterminate purpose. And it's a very interesting camera pan. So they're showing you each one of their faces as they realize the ion cloud or whatever that was is actually down there on the planet briefly.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about this for me was they didn't really do too much work on that ion cloud for the remastered version.
No, not at all.
I wonder what the thinking was there. I guess it's sort of akin to changing the design of a major character.
Yeah, you're probably right on that, Nate. I think they've been very respectful of the source material. So at this point, maybe they assume that changing it would be too drastic a measure.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, Cochran is kind of playing off the fact that there's anything else there. He was kind of trying to make Kirk think they were seeing things for a minute there. And now he's finally admitted that there is something there and it's called the Companion. So, it brought him there and saved his life. He was dying. Ah.
Yeah.
So interesting that he originally denied it, though. You know, what did he think would come of him admitting that it was there? You know, what negative outcome could that have had?
Yeah, especially when it's something you were going to have to address at some point anyway. Maybe he was just looking for the right time.
Hmm.
Or maybe he was planning on keeping it secret. Who knows? You know, go off, you know, do your standing meditation where you summon the companion, do what you got to do, and then come back inside.
Hmm. Oh, and the big reveal. Zefram Cochrane of Alpha Centauri. Wasn't Alpha Centauri where the guy was from in the last Starfighter?
I think you're right, yeah.
Yeah, the what was his name? Ugh, this is going to scare. I'm going to have to watch that movie again. Oh, man, that's going to kill me. I love that movie, too. And now I'm blanking on the guy's name. But interesting they picked Alpha Centauri. So I guess we were supposed to assume by if we've seen the First Contact film, I guess we're supposed to assume that maybe he went to Alpha Centauri after he left Earth in the warp ship.
Yeah, maybe that was his home planet, you know, or, you know, his planet of choice after winding up in space. I kind of have a little bit of issue with the Zefram that we have here versus the one in the movie, because they are so incredibly different.
Extremely. Extremely. So we're, if you were to watch them in the order that they are supposed to have occurred, the First Contact film would have occurred first in history, and you would see this drunken, money-grubbing, you know, almost bum of a scientist, you know, creating this warp ship for profit. And now we see this guy who is far and away different. He's not anywhere near the character that you saw in First Contact.
Yeah.
Granted, a lot of time has elapsed, and he's probably been exposed to a great number of circumstances and beings and aliens and things of that nature that could have altered him drastically. I mean, maybe even just being here with the companion for as long as he has would have changed him completely.
Yeah, yeah.
Hmm.
It almost seems like in First Contact, he was sort of cherry-picked out of this episode to sort of be, be a little bit of fan service to those people who were paying attention or were fans of the original series, and, you know, seeing that name and knowing how important he was. And here we get some of the biggest overacting of the series.
Oh, yeah.
We've seen a lot of freakouts over the course of this series, but that one it didn't do anything for me.
No, and you know, the thing that bugs me about this is that up until this point, she's been kind of like hard-nosed.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like the bee in the room and, you know, the tough nut. And then all of a sudden, seemingly out of nowhere, you know, as Cochrane's describing the situation that they're in and the situation that he's in, all of a sudden she finds that so reprehensible and disgusting that she freaks and breaks down. It's very weird.
Yeah. The only thing, again, is if I try to excuse it, I say maybe it's a side effect of her illness.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Yeah. But That's the fun thing about trying to, you know, in a show like this, you can find excuses for things.
Sure. Sure. You know, I think if I have to, you know, there's a lot of things to criticize here, but this episode in particular illustrates something that I've heard a lot of people who don't like Star Trek cite as one of the reasons that they don't like Star Trek. And that is, it's just a lot of people talking to each other. You know, there's not a lot of this version doesn't have a lot of action. This episode is kind of, it's a dialogue heavy episode. you know, not a lot goes on. You know, it, you know, there's no phaser fire. There's no, you know, ships fighting each other. The aliens aren't particularly interesting. You know, you got no Gorn. You know, no Klingon. Yeah. So
it's almost like a reverse bottle episode, too.
Right. Yeah. It's a right. Exactly. Uh oh.
Here's the companion.
And here it is. And it's a very strange looking pattern on that alien entity thing. It's like a yellow blob with some colored blobs floating in it. And Spock's going to attempt to touch it. Great acting on Nimoy's part.
Yeah. He was reacting to nothing.
Yeah,
check and that we might have finally found something that Spock cannot mind meld with.
That's true. That's true. It's interesting. He was sweeping his arm back and forth through it, and suddenly it seemed okay with it at first. But then, now you would think that the companion would be really curious about Spock in particular, because it's only had Cochrane for the longest time, and now this is the first non-human it's seen in presumably a very long time, if ever, right? So you would think, like, oh, hey, check this dude out. He's quite a bit different. He's got a completely different metabolism. His blood is green.
Yeah, although at this point, I guess you can assume that the companion is in full-on Zefram Cochrane crush mode.
I suppose. But, you know, I have to say, This is one chick that Kirk couldn't pull away from who she was interested in. So that's a negative on Kirk there. Usually he can pull the chicks off of whoever they're attached to.
Yeah.
But so he's summoning the companion supposedly just by clearing his mind. He just kind of stands there and out it comes from seemingly nowhere. It kind of looks like Cousin It, doesn't it?
It does. It does. I was trying to figure out what it reminded me of.
Either that or a bell.
Yeah.
A transparent bell. Oh, and check that out. It's kind of engulfing him.
Yeah. That's a pretty cool effect, too.
It is. So McCoy is attempting to give him some sort of an analysis of what it is. Now, you'd think that this wouldn't be so odd. With all the other things that they've seen in their travels so far, this wouldn't be something that was, kind of shocking or striking.
Yeah. It'd be like, oh, another day, another weird alien.
Yeah, think, oh, at least it's not Trelane again.
Yeah, or an omelet.
Yep, flying omelet. Imagine if they accidentally stumbled onto the home world of the flying omelets.
Oh, man.
Ooh. That could have been disastrous. But no, this time it's just some kind of cloud. They've seen those before. And we'll see one again very soon, actually. A slightly more interesting cloud, if I may be so bold. So. Yep. Now, this is an interesting thing. So the companion supposedly saved Cochrane's life, but it can't help our dying female friend there. It can do nothing to help her with her disease. For some reason, we're supposed to understand that it can't, but it seems more like it won't. Later on, it's more like it wouldn't.
Yeah. That's an interesting sort of idea to explore, because you're creating, the thought that the companion has, you know, ulterior motives or dibs on the body even.
Yeah.
You know, the companion's a really sort of interesting character that doesn't really get exposed too much in terms of, you know, getting to know it. But I mean, if you really think about the character, it's a pretty neat character.
Yeah, it is. Now we're learning that it's based in some sort of electricity. And they're rigging up a device that's going to short out the companion or disrupt it in a way. And looks like Cochrane's not too happy about that.
Yeah. The thing I like about the companion character is it's not an artificial intelligence. It's not a robot. It's not an android. It actually thinks, I don't want to say with a certain level of logic, but it's not as black and white as some of the other weird characters that we've seen pop up on this, you know, computers or, you know, Nomad, whatever we decided he was.
Yeah, and Cochran's got some sort of a Stockholm syndrome going on here, where he's developed an affection for it, you know, his captor, and it's been keeping him there.
And it saved his life.
Right. So, but he's you know, content to stay there with it, even though, you know, he's technically alone. You know, they can't verbally communicate. It has to, you know, absorb him so that they can commune, right? So that seems like a hefty price to pay for having your life saved. I mean, it's almost like you might as well be dead.
Well, yeah. Yeah. And at the same time, he's 150 years away from the life that he knew and the people he knew and the world that he knew. So, you know, how does, you know, I'd imagine it would be very, very hard for him to sort of reintegrate into this society.
No, I don't know. Maybe. They don't seem all that far apart. Oof. You know, the device has caused the companion changed to red. And now it's not happy.
Sour.
Yes, it is very unhappy, and it is moving at a high rate of speed. Oh, everybody's getting the beat down now. Great, great acting. Look at this.
Yeah.
Oh, man. This is one of your stereotypical Star Trek moments.
Yeah.
That people always refer to when they talk about Shatner's overacting, you know, with his reactions to being, you know, throttled around the room by this ghostly creature. McCoy is pleading for their lives.
Yeah, and thank goodness for McCoy. Who knows what would have happened?
Well, I guess Cochran's going to save him.
Yeah, I guess it was really just a matter of Cochran.
He's doing his summoning thing, and now it's... So now we know that the companion changes color with its moods.
Yeah, it's...
I wonder what color it would be for a... Well, I guess yellow is like a neutral mood. Red seems mad. I guess what would green be? If we're going to go by stoplights, maybe. You know, red equals bad.
Yeah, it seems like there's a little green in that there.
Yeah, some blue in there. But that's whatever pattern it's flashing. But I wonder if there's a book out there we can look up that has the different colors for each companion mood and what they mean.
I'm sure. And Kirk just made a really interesting point here. McCoy said he saved you. And Kirk said, I'm not sure, you know, that's a great thing. And McCoy says, well, how can you say that? And Kirk says, well, how do you fight something like this? There's really no obvious, you know, way to fight a being of that nature.
Given the proper amount of time, I think Spock could probably figure something out.
Yeah. But yeah. Kirk seems pretty perplexed. And now we have another huge important aspect of this episode, which is the reference to the Universal Translator.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which I don't recall ever actually seeing prior to this.
No, I don't.
I think it's been referenced.
Yeah, I don't think we've actually seen it.
But here we actually see the device itself, and here is the Enterprise.
Finally.
Yeah.
27-ish minutes in.
27 minutes in.
And Scotty is... The chair is... The captain's chair is turned in a strange direction.
Yeah.
I didn't know it could turn that far around.
No.
Yeah. So interesting that Scotty was using the communications on the chair spun around a different way. Pretty interesting. So the rest of the ship's complement seems to be, you know, in their places. Mm-hmm. You know, we got our Sulu moment here.
Yeah. And one of our listeners, Matt, reminded us that a lot of the episodes this season where we're not seeing Sulu are due to the fact that he was off filming the Green Berets.
Hmm.
So thank you for reminding us, Matt, of that fact. It helps explain away the odd Sulu appearances that we get.
You know, that's kind of strange because usually you think these people who are doing these TV shows, they're committed to doing the TV show. You know, it's almost like saying, oh, one of our main characters, he's kind of, yeah, we could take or leave him. He can be gone for a few months and it's no problem.
But who were really the series regulars in terms of like opening credits? All you get is Shatner, Nimoy, and DeForest Kelly.
Yeah, but by this time you're good way into the second season. You've seen the faces that you've seen time and time and time again. You're used to seeing.
Yeah.
You know, even if you're back in the 60s watching this as it was airing, these characters are all recognizable from past episodes and you've seen them so many times. You would think that people would think, "Wait, what happened to that character? Where did he go? Why isn't he around anymore?" And, you know, they didn't kill him off or we didn't see it on screen. What happened to him? But, you know, usually, in today's times, that's kind of almost unheard of for a regular character to disappear for several episodes without any explanation whatsoever. Yeah.
It might have been one of those things where it was like, hey, this is a good gig for me. Would you mind?
Yeah. You never know. I guess, you know, back then things might have been different as far as that's concerned. I guess Sulu is quote unquote a minor character. So, you know, they could just have a fill in sit there. I guess maybe it would have been different if it was Shatner or Nimoy or Kelly that needed to be out for, you know, 5 or 6 episodes here and there.
Yeah. And that's why you see their name right at the beginning of the opening titles.
Yeah. This is their show.
Yeah.
All the rest of you are just here for supporting cast. You can come and go as you please.
So now they've rigged up a device that is going to disable the companion, right? It's an electrical charge.
Yep. They're trying again, but you know, this could be quite dangerous because we saw what happened last time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're doing a little more communing here. It looks a little bigger this time.
Yeah. It definitely, the perspective definitely seems different, or the, you know, its dimensions.
Mm. Oh, that's the universal translator.
Yeah.
So they're going to try to talk to it.
Yeah, and the companion's instantly amazed by the fact that it's communicating with a human.
Yeah, this is pretty interesting that it's able to finally communicate back, and it's a female.
Yeah, and it's actually a voice that we recognize.
Hmm.
That is the voice of Elizabeth Rogers, who was on the Doomsday Machine in Uhura's Place.
Oh, fascinating.
And she will pop up once again in The Way to Eden.
Oh, pretty cool.
But
pretty
here cool. She provides the voice of the companion.
Oh, she's one of the hippies?
I'm not sure. I wasn't sure if she sat in the communications chair again or not.
Oh. Well, I know Uhura's in that episode.
Oh, okay.
Now I got some of the songs stuck in my head. Thanks for mentioning that episode.
My pleasure. So yeah. They're pleading with the companion here. They're saying, hey, you know, we have a person here that if we can't leave this planet is going to die. So, you know, that kind of supersedes any plans you might have for us.
Yeah, and the companion is trying to justify keeping them there by saying that Cochrane needs human companionship.
Yeah.
So he's lonely.
Mm-hmm.
And this is interesting too, because now the companion is telling them that they have stopped aging and they will continue to live there indefinitely. So they won't, nothing can hurt them. They'll be taken care of and they won't age anymore.
Yeah, and it's kind of like you said earlier, it's kind of like a gilded cage.
Mm. Oh, for sure.
Because what's the point of not aging if there's nothing to do?
Sure. And we now we've had two episodes in a row where the crew is stuck in gilded cages.
Yeah.
iMud was quite gilded. And here we are. I think I would have preferred the iMud prison to this one.
Oh, hands down.
Yeah. This seems pretty desolate. Yeah. Now everybody's got to cram in that little house.
Oh, yeah. No, if I was on the crew during the iMud, I would have been like, I vote for hanging out here.
Yep. Yep. Definitely.
Let them take care of us.
Can you make me an Andrea, please? Oh, man. It's good. This one's kind of lame.
But you know what? Getting back to the Universal Translator, I think it was great to see this much explanation given to it.
Hmm.
You know, Kirk really gives sort of a – he gives the – you know, the real quick, you know, the pitch, you know, almost like the Shark Tank version of the Universal Translator. Like, this is what it does and this is how it does it.
Yeah, but you don't get the zoom in on the handle where it says powered by Google. Oh, so, see, now Cochran's getting all bent now. He thinks that the translator is making the companion have a female voice.
Yeah, well, that's got to be a little bit of a, you know, a mind bender in terms of he's been spending a lot of intimate time with this, with the companion, and he's assumed it was a man, you know, they were bros, you know, and now he's finding out that it's a female that might, you know, very much have feelings for him.
Oh, boy. and Spock, the logical one, is the one that tells Cochran that the companion loves him.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I don't really feel the outrage that he feels. It doesn't really compute to me.
Yeah. Either way, he talks about how he's let it crawl around inside of his mind and his being and all that. If that thought alone creeps you out, it shouldn't matter if it was a male or a female, at least to me.
Yeah, and it's, 150 years. And I don't know. I think he's just, he's taking this a little too hard. You know, I don't know. I think I'd be kind of flattered if I was in his position, you know, and an alien, ethereal being that actually has feelings for him, a being that obviously has almost limitless power to do all of these things, where they can create things and food and can stop them from aging. That's pretty ideal, isn't it?
Yeah.
You say, hey, listen, man. I love you too. Keep me alive forever. I'm immortal now. That sounds like a small price to pay. You know? So back to Miss Hedford here, who's doing a questionable job of selling this sickness.
Yeah.
And she's got barely any energy, but she can talk about Cochran.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look at that blanket. It's like a gold blanket.
Yeah. And this is almost sort of the scene that sells the ending of the episode, where she indicates that she doesn't want to die, that she's sort of invested herself in her job,
mm-hmm.
and it's almost cost her some emotional connection. She says, I've never loved, and I've never been loved. So it almost makes the end of the episode not feel as,
creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It seems a little bit strange. Yeah. The setup here is a little bit too convenient.
I would say that overall, this is the strangest episode of Trek that we've watched so far.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we've seen all manner of episodes of this show so far, and I thought the alternative factor was strange, but this one is strange in a different way.
Yeah, I would probably put them on a similar level in terms of strangeness. That is a good point. You know, they're both very unique sort of in the... you know, in the feel of the episode, you know, this this episode has a weird feel to it for me. And it might be sort of the presence of two other, you know, lead characters really throughout the story, you know, in Cochran and Nancy.
Yeah. You got the, I get, we're back talking to the companion again. And see, this is another way Kirk's going to try to talk his way through this whole thing.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's a word count out there for every episode of Star Trek. And see which one has the highest word count. I bet you this one's pretty high up on the chain.
Yeah.
As far as dialogue.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. The one other thing, and I keep going back to the Universal Translator, is it's interesting that he's holding it here. Whereas I guess on the Enterprise, it's sort of just piped in, whereas if they're talking ship to ship, you know, they have like the Universal Translator app.
Well, this is the smartphone version, I guess. Yeah. The standalone version. But, you know, in order for a device like that to work, it just seems like it would have to have data pre-programmed in it, you know, so the Klingon language would have to be in that. And then, you know, the translation algorithms to translate it into English to match up with the English words that are also in the device. Like, it seems strange that it could. This is a being that no one's ever encountered aside from Cochran, I guess. But yet its language is understood by the Universal Translator.
Well, it's got that super algorithm that actually, I guess, mathematically breaks the language down and decodes it. Come on, man. Super, super powerful algorithm, right?
Being a programmer, it's difficult for me to think of input being translated into output with no frame of reference.
Well, it's almost like, breaking a code.
The code has to be coded within that code for you to break. Like, if I just started talking in gibberish into the Universal Translator, how would it know that's not a language as opposed to what this creature is doing?
Because it's Universal Translator.
Yeah, but then it could translate my gibberish into something.
But
if
no,
I
but
intend that to be, if I make up a language.
Well,
right?
If you make up a language, all of a sudden becomes a language, and you're going to be using words and phrases with probably some consistency that creates a code.
Not necessarily. If I just made things up off the top of my head, my own language, and started, you know, like, well, how would it know what word I intended another word to mean? It just doesn't seem to make any sense. Without any kind of frame of reference.
Yeah.
You know, take people's names, for instance. You know, how would it know that I was saying somebody's name in another language?
Yeah. I have to go back and watch Kirk's explanation of it again. So we just had a lot happen while we were discussing this. The companion indicated that it wanted to bond with Cochran. And Kirk explained why it couldn't. But now we have a very, very healthy Nancy Hedford. And McCoy cannot understand, you know, how she could be better. And Cochran
knows.
Instantly knows that it is
the companion. The companion is now is referring to itself as we. So now we're to assume that both of them are inside the body together.
Yeah, it explains that, you know, somehow they're both occupying the same body. But it seems like the companion is pretty much front and center here.
Those you knew as the commissioner and the companion are both here. Oh, and look at Spock is telling the companion what it doesn't have the power to do.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Now that's an interesting reference that the companion said that's for the maker of all things.
Yeah.
Yeah,
alluding to a higher power of some sort.
Yeah, that's not something we normally hear about. So there's a moral implication here, right?
Mm-hmm.
you know, the companion just kind of commandeered her body, but yet she's still in there. Right? So is this something that she wants to do, or is this something that she's being forced to do? Is she technically being quote unquote kidnapped in a way?
Yeah. But see, this almost sort of, you know, goes back to that deathbed confession almost, or that death, you know, where Nancy talked about, you know, regretting the fact that she never, you know, found love, never had the opportunity for love. So,
but the justification for taking her body is she was sick and we could die anyway.
Well, she was going to die.
I know that, but that's the justification though. That's what makes it okay.
Well, that almost seems to make it okay for Nancy.
Well, true. If she's okay with it, then we should be okay with it. But I'm just saying, would that be an acceptable justification in general? You know, it just seems like it wasn't a choice that she was given at the time. You know, just went in there, jumped on in, and
yeah,
but took over the body.
See, I wonder if the companion was in on that conversation. Or was the companion only present when we saw the companion?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm trying to put myself in her shoes and think of, you know, because pretty much the companion's doing all the steering here. It's doing all the talking. It's in control of the body. She's in there. You know, she's quote unquote alive, but, you know, what kind of life is that?
It could be like a dream, a perpetual dream state where, you know, in dreams, you're not really in control of what you're doing in a dream.
Well, what if the companion turns out to be a hoe and is hooking up with all kinds of dudes that Nancy doesn't like, right? She's got no choice. What if she doesn't think Cochran's handsome? What if she doesn't even like Cochran?
Yeah.
I don't know, dude. That seems like a questionable outcome to me.
Yeah.
I feel kind of bad for Nancy myself. I don't know. But anyway.
Well, look at it like this. Maybe Nancy had a one-bedroom apartment that she lived in for most of her life. And for whatever reason, she decided to get a roommate. And now she's living with a roommate.
Yeah, but she can't kick this one out.
So the Enterprise has found the shuttle, and they're en route. They'll be to them in 57 minutes, and they're going to transport the shuttlecraft to the Enterprise. Which, where do they beam that to? I guess there's another, you know, I guess the transporter can, we've already seen you don't really need that those transporter pods to actually really transport.
No, how convenient is it that her dress held up like that looks exactly like what the companion used to look like?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Oh, you know, here's the rub, though. Here's the rub. She can't leave the planet.
Yeah.
Her life emanates from the planet, so she can't leave. So now you're stuck, dude. Oh, man. There's always a catch. Mm-hmm. Always a catch.
Mm-hmm. But wouldn't that be almost like the right thing to do? So you're the companion here. You're not doing anything on this planet. You're all alone. Nancy's going to die anyway. Why not leave the planet? Have those last couple of days where you see and experience things you've never experienced before. And then, you know, move on.
Yeah, kind of makes sense. You know, actually, you know, if faced with that decision, I'm sure that's probably what I would choose, having been stuck there for so long.
Yeah. I mean, if I was the companion, that's what I would want. I'd be like, hey, you know, I want to see what's out there. Let me see as much of, as much as I can before I expire.
Yeah. Get me to that shore leave planet before I croak. And let me live out my wildest dreams. And that'll be good enough. Standard orbit. So the Enterprise has arrived. Scotty looking very proud.
Yeah. And they're going to beam it right to the shuttle bay. So,
yep. So here, I guess that's the first time we hear about them beaming something directly to another area of the ship, huh?
Yeah.
We've been waiting for that. We've been waiting for it. So now we can say that's another first. We can cross off the list. Oh, yeah. Boy.
And I and you know, before we get to our essential discussion, to wrap things up, Cochran pretty much decides he's going to stay behind hang out with the companion for as long as they can, I guess, because the companion doesn't have powers at this point anymore.
Well, that kind of sucks.
Spock's even telling him, you're going to grow old and you're going to die. And Cochran's like, hey, that's what happens. That's the circle of life. And the only thing you wonder is if they had come back, if somebody discovered this planet in 30 years, would there be a large family living there? They're both Nancy and Zephyrin both look like they're, you know, Zephyrin, it doesn't really matter how old he is. And Nancy looks healthy and, you know, looks within the right range to bear a child.
I guess they have no food, looks like no water source, it's all rocks and dirt.
There's vegetation there, though. There's trees.
Mm-hmm. So, are edible trees? I don't know. No. It does not look like the most ideal of places. Look at the whole out in the distance. It's all rocks.
Yeah.
And there's no medical care there. So what happens if there's complications and pregnancies? You know, she's gonna give birth to a child with no hospital, no nurses, no doctors, no hot running water.
Yeah.
I don't know, dude.
All right. So that's
The shuttle's flying back to the Enterprise.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. You're supposed to beam it.
All right. Well.
That's weird.
Hmm.
Yeah. So I guess the essential nature of this episode we should discuss. I have a feeling that our answer is going to be the same. So you want to take it, or you want me to take it, or?
Well, I guess, yeah. I'm begrudgingly saying that it's essential just because of the introduction of Zephyrin Cochran. You kind of need that, the father of warp drive, and he does recur back in a major Star Trek motion picture, and he's mentioned all over the place. So this is, quote-unquote, the origin or the beginnings of Zephyrin Cochran in the Trek universe. So that alone, I believe, makes it an essential episode. The episode itself is not exactly great.
No.
It's very uninspiring to me, but I think that if you're looking to get everything out of the original series that you can, story-wise and universe-wise, then this is a required episode.
Yeah, and I also think to, you know, pile onto that is I think the more detailed explanation of the Universal Translator is a significant, you know, thing that's covered in terms of, you know, helping you understand the universe a little more.
Yeah. Yeah. I can buy into that.
Mm-hmm.
I can buy into that. So sounds like a slightly begrudged double essential on this one.
Yes.
You know, that just goes to prove to everyone out there, we don't just look for episodes that we like and call them essential, because I don't particularly, I don't think this is actually a horrible episode, but it's not one that I would necessarily, you know, go do to watch for, you know, amusement. If I'm looking for just to watch a fun Star Trek episode, this probably wouldn't make the cut.
Yeah.
For me. So at any rate, we are at the end of our episode this week. As always, we're out there on social media, Twitter at TTT_pod, Facebook.com/TriCorderTransmissions. And our own website at thetricornertransmissions.com. So hopefully we'll see you on social media, and we'll see you again next week.
Gene Coon strikes again. I gotta tell you, I love Gene Coon, and I respected him. And although he was no longer associate producer for Star Trek's second season, he continued to write his incredibly layered and wonderfully conceived teleplays. Metamorphosis is hailed as one of the series' more perceptive episodes. As in The Devil in the Dark, the script's core was man's intolerance of those different from him.
The Enterprise crew is marooned on a planet with Zefram Cochrane, the illustrious scientist who discovered warp drive 100 years before. With him is a creature called the Companion. We're about to learn something intriguing about the relationship between two very different beings.